it's because I don't like him, albeit just for stupid, jealous reasons, but the first thing I think isn't, maybe we could get him to find out what's going on from some of our indie kids here. It's, what does he know that he's not telling us? Because he made a joke out of it, didn't he? He showed up, and the indie kids started dying. Someone clever would point that out themselves and say how worried they were that they'd start being blamed, especially if they were to blame. But then, so would someone who really did show up innocently. He grinds his cigarette out with his foot. Then he picks up the butt and looks around for somewhere to throw it away so he's not littering, which, okay, is maybe not the action of a killer. Still. He throws it in a trash can down by a car, then stands looking into the windows of the restaurant. He doesn't do anything, doesn't wave at anyone or try to catch anyone's attention, despite having a view of almost all of Jared's section, and definitely the booth where Meredith, Mel, and Henna sit. He looks sad again, or sad still, whatever. He turns into the night, gazing at the cars driving by, at the stars and moon that still shine there. What are you waiting for, former indie kid? With a sigh, he disappears behind the other side of the restaurant, heading toward the entrance, where once inside he'll no doubt pass the pissed-off seniors and annoyed firemen who are wondering where the hell their waiters got to. I hurry back in, still wiping my hands, wondering what I've seen. Wondering if I've seen anything. I probably haven't. But what was he doing out there? And what do we know about him, really? Chapter the 11th, in which Satchel, mourning her friends but pressing on feistily, keeps researching her amulet with the card catalog. The mysterious boy appears in her bedroom one night, and his first words are, "I'm sorry." He tells her he is the prince in the court of the immortals. His mother, the empress, wants to take over this world, sensing great food here to feed their immortality. They seek to open more fissures, find more permanent vessels in which to live. But the prince has fallen in love with Satchel from afar, and can't stand idly by while her world is enslaved. "I've come to help," he says. They kiss. B. "And so it is, with great pleasure and excitement," my mom says, standing at the podium, smiling into the bright lights of the cameras, "that I announce my candidacy to represent the people of the 8th Congressional District of the great state of Washington." There's applause from her supporters and from the party officials gathered around her. She smiles back at us, but just with her mouth. And I realize my dad is the only one of us clapping along. I elbow Mel, and she and I and Meredith start slapping our hands together, looking like the perfect family we totally aren't. I'm even wearing a suit. Mom's satisfied and turns back to the cameras. In truth, there aren't all that many. There's one main feed that'll supply footage to the network affiliates if they want it, one camera from the local independent station that mostly shows reruns, and another supplied by the party itself for internet campaigning. There are some print and web journalists too, but all in all, I think interested public are outnumbered by politicians and family. "State Senator Mitchell?" a local journalist asks when the applause has died down. "You don't really need the state in front of it, Ed," my mom says, smiling wide. "What do you have to say about Tom Shuren, your expected opponent?" Ed, the journalist, continues. "I say that I welcome a vigorous and clean campaign based on the issues I outlined in my speech," my mom says, smiling like a president. You may not like politicians much. I don't. But she's good at her job. I can't remember a single one of the issues from her speech, only the vague sense that she really cared about them. Which, she told me, is the perfect result. If you're too specific, people will purposely mishear you so they can be outraged about whatever thing that usually outrages them. You want to get them on your side emotionally, apparently, where they ask fewer questions. They want us a bit dumb and a bit afraid. Which, for the most part, I think we are. "What about the rest of your family, Alice?" a nastier voice says. I recognize it. It's this woman who runs a bitter but annoyingly significant little blog about how local politicians are morons for not agreeing with everything she thinks. We wouldn't want a repeat of the tragedies that scuttled your run for lieutenant governor. I see Mel's face set in some fairly unfiltered hatred that I hope the cameras aren't capturing, but my mom doesn't miss a beat. I have a normal American family, Cynthia, and just like any family, we try to face our challenges with grace and dignity. I love my children more than anything in the world, and I would never do this if I didn't have their complete support. I wonder if that's true. And, my mother goes on, her voice actually emotional. I would take great issue if any press decided to go after my children. Her voice goes tough, but it's politician tough, and I wonder again if it's true. They'd have one ferocious mama bear to deal with first. Her campaign team bursts into spontaneous applause. How you holding up, Dad? Mel asks him as the press conference winds down. Hmm? He says, looking at her vaguely. He's in a suit as well, of course, and from the smell of him, reasonably sober. He takes a drink of the coffee provided while my mom does a few friendly interviews. Oh, you know, he says. Another year, another campaign. He pats his pockets, but doesn't look like he expects to find anything there. We'll get by. My mom comes over in her power blue dress and her power pearl necklace. Thank you, she says, and it's so genuine we all feel a little embarrassed. You did great. You're welcome, Mel says, wary as ever. Mama bear, huh? My mom gives a tight smile. I'm really not going to let them get to you, Melinda. You have my word. You can't control that, Mel says. But thanks. It's a small race. I don't think they'll bother. My mother stiffens a little at small race, and Mel immediately closes her eyes. Not what I meant. I know, my mom says. You two will be out of here before it really heats up. It's the first time she's acknowledged this. She sounds kind of sad. We'll get by, I hear myself saying. We'll get by. We've taken separate cars to get here, my mom coming up from the Capitol with her team, my dad under orders to clean up enough to get there for the evening. He can do it, if you push him, and my mom really, really knows how to push him. Who knows what their secret married life is like? I can't even imagine it, don't ever want to, and feel like I have less clue about it as time passes. But whatever, it seems to work for them. Mel drives Dad and Meredith back home. I ride with my mom. The best thing is that it's only 6 months to the election, so it's a short campaign, my mom says, pushing on through the dark. Normally, for a seat this big, I'd have had to be running for at least the last year. She glances over at me. Which would have been worse. You'd still have run, though. Yeah, I probably would have. And you and your sister judge me for that, I know. We don't judge you. To my surprise, she snorts. Yes, you do. I judged my parents. That's what young people do, isn't it? Her parents live in North Dakota. I've met them about 4 times in 17 years of life. I wonder if she just kept on judging them. I do all this for you guys, you know? She says. I know you think it's just ambition and power-seeking, and well, for goodness sake, I'm a politician, and I wouldn't be a politician if those things weren't there too, but it's not just that. I don't know what to say. She never talks like this. Never hints that there's anything behind her motivations other than pure patriotic public service. Are you feeling okay? I ask. The thing is, I'm not even surprised you'd ask that. We've forgotten how to talk to each other, haven't we? Funny how things evolve, and then one day you look up and they're different. You don't believe in evolution. She laughs. Actually laughs. Well, not politically, I don't. She looks over at me again. I wonder what you think of me. Really. What kind of a person am I when seen by you? I keep quiet, hoping like hell this is a rhetorical question. It is. I am feeling okay, she says. But I'm also stepping into the big time, son. This isn't local government with all its little tyrants and petty feuds. This is national office. Which has big tyrants and dangerous feuds. Absolutely. She sighs. I thought it was all over with the lieutenant governor's race. That I'd be in local office forever. Maybe end up on a school board someday or a state commission for something or other. But all of a sudden, in the space of a few weeks, here it all is. The big show. If you win, I will. Yeah, she probably will. What do you do when your dreams are about to come true? She asks. No one ever tells you. They tell you to chase them, but what happens when you actually catch one? You enjoy it, do your best, try not to be a dick. Language. But she's not upset. I really do this for you guys, though, whatever you may believe. They're my dreams, yes, but they're dreams of a world I can make better for you. Us specifically? Me and Mel and Meredith? Your generation. I know you guys face some tough things. Do you? I want to help with that. Do you? Quit saying that. I was a teenager once too. I know what goes on. You do? I risk. She frowns at me. She looks in the rearview mirror, checking out for Mel in the car behind us. I saw stuff you wouldn't believe, she says under her breath. My ears prick. What stuff? I ask carefully. She just shakes her head. The world isn't safe, Mike. It just isn't. I wish it was, but it's not. I worry for you and Mel. I worry myself sick for Meredith, that the future's going to have enough for her to be happy and protected. You need to let her go to the Bolts of Fire concert. I know, she deserves it. She's going to miss you two so much. I leave that alone, because it doesn't feel like it belongs to her. Trees pass us by in the night. I watch them, looking for strange blue lights, I guess, but not finding any. What stuff did you see? I ask again. When you were a teenager? Nothing, she says too quickly. Are you ready for your finals? Yes, what do you mean, nothing? Mike, she says, warning. The mistake of every young person is to think they're the only ones who see darkness and hardship in the world. That's what the cop said, I mumble. What cop? She snaps. On TV, I say, pleased at myself for thinking so fast. The mistake of every adult, though, is to think darkness and hardship aren't important to young people because we'll grow out of it. Who cares if we will? Life is happening to us now, just like it's happening to you. What's happening to you now? She says, her voice changing, alert as a meerkat. Mom, tell me. Are you okay? I didn't mean, I think you did mean, she says. Teens argue with their parents. That's the law of nature. Doesn't mean we stop caring about you. Doesn't mean we stop being parents. Dad stopped a long time ago. There's a really, really dangerous silence at this. I find that I don't actually care. Your father, she starts, but she doesn't finish. He checked out after he stole all that money from Uncle Rick, I say. He never checked back in. Mel loves him still, so where did he go? And why can't I bring him back? I don't know. I wish I did. He was there tonight. He was about 40% there tonight, and the sad thing is, we all thought that was a victory. She doesn't say anything to this, just stares ahead into the darkened road. I feel bad now for wrecking the mood on her big announcement night, though I'm still wondering what she saw as a teenager. Was that the time of the undead? Why have I never thought that she might have seen all this stuff too? You didn't say what was happening with you, she says. I need to know. I want to know. Not for the campaign. Because I'm your mother. I don't answer her. I don't want to. But then I do. I think I need to see a psychiatrist again, I say. I think I need to go back on medication. There's the smallest of pauses, like she's slotting the information into some grid in her head. The compulsive stuff? She asks.
Yep.
It's gotten that bad? It's gotten really, really bad. I watch her absorb this. I watch her nod. Okay. Okay? I say, surprised. Of course, she says, also surprised. Why wouldn't it be?
Well,
the campaign, for one. Didn't you hear me? Weren't you listening to that ferocious mama bear crap? I assumed that was something the party wrote for you in case you got asked about Mel. Well, okay, that's true, but Lieutenant Governor would have been the big time too. And that's when everything went to hell. You can't blame us for being a little weirded out by it. No, she says, after a second. No, I can't. Is it because of the campaign? Your trouble? I don't think so. It started before Mankiewicz died. This isn't me trying to tell you not to run. I think it's just life and graduation and everything changing. And zombie deer, I don't say. And kids at my school dying. And Henna and her spirit of exploration. We'll work it out, she says. I promise. I'll talk to my team and work something out. Why does your team need to know? They need to know everything a journalist might find out. That way they can protect us. We're nearly home, and I don't say anything more. I certainly don't ask what it might be like for families that don't need protection from their parents' jobs. Strange. It feels like we'd almost got somewhere, but then missed it. I'm surprised at how disappointed I feel. When I go to bed, there's a text from Jared. Not bad in a suit there, Mikey. I text back. You saw it? Was it gruesome? Jared. All politics is/are gruesome. Me. Will you have to be at your dad's? Jared. He doesn't get a press conference. He's announcing on Twitter. Me. Oh, sorry. Jared. Don't be. Makes him seem like the undergod. Me. Did you just type undergod? Jared. Underdog. Me. Does anyone use Twitter anymore? Jared. Underdog. Before I put my phone away, I text Mel. You all right? Counting the days, she texts back from her bedroom. Me. Dad was okay. She doesn't answer. Me. I like Call Me Steve. Mel. Me too. I put my phone back on my side table to go to sleep, but it buzzes again. Mel. What's going to happen to Meredith when we go? Me. She'll be better than all of us, the only one who won't need therapy. Mel. I don't trust anyone who doesn't need therapy. Me. You don't trust anyone, period. Mel, I trust you.
Chapter the 12th, in which Satchel's love for the prince grows real and true and like nothing she's ever known before. Second indie kid Finn feels her distance and is hurt, but she tells him, no one can provide the heart its own peace. You have to find it yourself. Dylan, to her surprise, is the one who gives her space. Even better, no one else has died. They follow the prince's instructions on where and when to be, and all danger is avoided. Satchel and the prince kiss again, but he respects her too much to demand more. B. The word finals makes it sound like a bigger deal than it is. At least for us. We were all college prep, so most of the hard work had to be done early enough to prove to colleges we'd be worth indebting ourselves forever to them. The final for U.S. history was just that Civil War essay, for example, which we all managed to get turned in on time, splitting the questions so me and Mel didn't do the same one. The rest of our major tests have at least two of us in each class, so lunches turn into study sessions. For me, my only real worries are calc and English. What is the limit as x approaches 1 of 1 minus x squared over x to the 4th minus x? I read. Iambic pentameter, Mel says. You are?
Minus 2/3, Hannah answers.
We look up to Jared. Yep, he says.
It's not iambic pentameter? Mel says.
You're definitely bic pentameter, Hannah says. In those shoes, anyway.
Because they look like 4 feet? Mel says.
Can I squeeze in? Nathan says, appearing at our table.
Why does he do that? Always arrive late? He never comes with anyone, just wanders in after we're all together. What's he up to?
I brought that essay I did last year on Zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, he says, handing it to me. Me and Mel are the only two in AP English, and that awful, awful book is one of our exam texts, so he's really helping us out here. Thanks, I say, a bit surly. Don't be too thankful, I only got a B, and I still don't have a clue what the hell the book was about.
No one does, Mel says. I think that's the point. Did you even finish it? I ask her.
She hesitates.
Ish.
Listen, Nathan says.
This is,
I say, flipping through his essay,
long.
They called it Core College in Tulsa, he says, and they really weren't kidding.
Listen,
let me see, Mel says, reaching over for the essay.
Is this right?
Hannah asks Jared, showing him some calc work. He scans it in an instant. All fine, he says. I don't know why you're worried, Hannah. You're as good as me.
Meredith isn't even as good as you, she says, frowning at her paper.
Guys? Nathan says. Crap, Mel says, reading his essay. This is really smart, like really smart, so much smarter than me.
I doubt that, I say.
What is this word even? She points on the page, holding it up. Ossification, Nathan says.
What kind of 16-year-old writes ossification? Mel says, her voice ticking up in slight panic. Why do I not use ossification?
I was 17, actually. I'm 18 now.
Me too, says Hannah.
Me too, says Jared.
I'm 19, says Mel, and I know nothing of ossification.
I'll be 18 in June. Jared is only 2 months older than me, but I'd sort of forgotten that this was the 2 months where I'm at least a whole year younger than everyone else. Including, it seems, Nathan, who's still trying to ask us something.
I'd like to paint the bridge, he says,
and everyone looks at him, shocked.
If you guys would do it with me.
It's a senior tradition to paint the railroad bridge near the school. Buses, students, and staff all drive under it every morning to reach the school gates. Most of the things written there are boring.
Gina, Joelle, Stephanie, friends forever.
Yes, seriously. For. Ever. Stupid. Here I paint all broken-hearted. And then they didn't leave enough room to finish the poem. Or vulgar slash threatening. Anderson sucks dicks. Anderson being our wildly unliked shop teacher and basketball coach, who probably never in fact engages in the behavior in question. The tags get painted over by other boring, stupid, or obscene tags in a matter of days, but it's tradition, as if that alone is reason enough. Slavery and buying your wife were traditions, too. It's also technically illegal, of course, so it has to be done at night, usually deep in the darkest part. We were never going to do it anyway. We're exactly the sort of nice kids who would consider it too stupid to bother. Jared didn't even do it with the football team when we beat our district rival in the last game. To finish the season 2-7. Woohoo, go team. But with all the blue-eyed cops, the blue-eyed deer,
and indie kids dying from probably blue-eyed causes, it was definitely out of the question. Until Nathan suggested it. "You're not even from here," I said, over that study lunch. But I was already too late. I could see the eyes of the others light up.
"Exactly," Nathan said. "I'm not from anywhere. I've got nothing. No traditions, no friends except you guys. And you," he said to me, "don't even like me."
I waited too long to protest.
"I just," he said, shrugging, "I want something I did in high school to be high school-y, so I can look back in 50 years and say, at least I did something stupid and young as proof that I was there."
And that kinda cracked it. Henna agreed immediately. Mel said his story made her sad, but not doing it would now make her sadder. And Jared said,
"Why not?"
"Because zombie deer,"
I say now, shivering even though it's not actually all that cold, even in the middle of the night. We're in my car again, parked a block away from the rail bridge.
"And cops with murder in their eyes, and actual dead people."
"There's enough of us," Jared says, squashed in the back seat with Nathan and Mel.
Henna gets the passenger seat because of her still broken arm, and because she's Henna.
"We'll be careful, and we'll be all right."
Nathan holds up his backpack.
"I got 5 cans, one color for each of us. Nearly got arrested."
"Nearly doesn't count," I say.
"Silver, gold, blue, red, and yellow."
He looks at me in the rearview mirror.
"You get yellow."
"Are we going to do this or not?" Mel yawns.
"I vote not," I say.
"Enough, Mikey,"
Henna says, scornfully enough to make my stomach hurt. She gets out of the car. The back seat follows her, and I'm last, looking like I'm pouting as I accept the can of yellow paint. The bridge isn't actually all that big, crossing just 2 lanes of an old logging road. There are embankments on either side leading up to it, and people sometimes paint the concrete ledges of these, too. We don't. We don't want to waste any time. I follow Henna up the right embankment where she's walking with Mel. Jared and Nathan head up the other side. The idea is you stand on the bridge and lean over the top, writing whatever you want from above. There's a lot of shaking of paint cans, a lot of the metallic pinging sound of the ball bearing they leave inside to stir the paint.
"We don't have white," I whisper, loud enough for everyone to hear. "You're supposed to have white to paint over what went before."
"Not if you're creative enough," Nathan says. He's already reached the far end of the bridge, and with his can of gold paint, he turns a shoddily painted cardinal,
our sad school mascot, I've never seen a live one the whole of my life I've lived in this state, into, I'll admit it, a fairly nifty-looking bumblebee. I see Jared nod in appreciation, and my irritated stomach growls some more. Mel's got the dark blue, and has made her way to the middle of the bridge, leaning over decisively and painting "A Year Too Late" in puffy blue letters over some streaked puffy pink ones that obviously got rained on.
"Do you really believe that?" I ask her.
"Oh," she says. I had no idea this was about what we really believed. She pops the cap back on her paint can, takes out her phone, and starts texting Call Me Steve, who's on nights. I lean out over the bridge to see what Nathan's finishing up. The bumblebee now flies away from a golden arm that it's just stung. "Leave your sting behind," he writes.
"Bees die when they do that," I say.
Henna nudges me, annoyed.
"It's a metaphor," Nathan says.
"Metaphorical bees die too." Jared's at work with the silver paint, covering up a heart celebrating the no doubt eternal love of Oliver and Shania. He takes the gold paint from Nathan and sprays a circle and some markings against the still wet bed of silver.
"What's that?" Nathan asks.
"Kind of my own personal tag," Jared says.
I don't recognize it, but I can see a line of cats stopped just outside the streetlight down the road. I wonder if it's a kind of standing blessing for them, as long as it lasts. They don't come any closer, and I also wonder if they know Jared doesn't want them to. No one's told Nathan that anything's different about Jared. It's a pact we all silently keep. Who'd believe us anyway? Indie kids are dying before their eyes, and no one's even guessing at what's probably the real reason. These immortals that Meredith found. Or not. But it sure as hell isn't accident or suicide.
Why are you in such a bad mood?
Henna says to me, shaking her can of red paint. I shrug, still pouty.
I like Nathan, she says.
I know. I've heard all about your uncontrollable attraction.
And I like you, Mike, though not very much tonight, I have to say.
There's something up with him. Where did he come from? Why does he always join us late? Why doesn't he...
Jealousy makes you ugly.
And assuming this is all about you makes you ugly, I hiss. She turns from me, furious, and leans over the bridge, can at the ready. But she doesn't spray anything.
Look,
she says, stepping back. It's hard to see in the way the streetlight is angled at us, but there are markings along the top of the railing of the bridge.
Words.
Names, Mel says, looking close.
Finn, Henna reads. Kerouac, Joffrey, Earth.
She looks at Mel.
It's the kids who died.
But why up here? Jared says. Where no one can see them. I look at Nathan. Maybe it's the killers, I say, still annoyed. Maybe they put the names up here as trophies. Maybe this is the most dangerous place we could have come tonight.
Would you stop it?
Henna says. She touches the names on the railing. The paint is black, simple. Just names. Look, Nathan says, kneeling down. At our feet are small flowers. Little more than tiny wildflowers, really, but different kinds, spread along the side of the rail tracks under the names of the dead indie kids. Henna touches them softly.
I'll bet this is their way of remembering them. A kind of memorial.
She stands.
One that no one can see, but that they know is here.
No one's painted over it, Jared says. Or kicked away the flowers, Mel says.
I wonder if everyone knows about this except us.
I don't feel like painting anything anymore, Henna says, handing her can back to Nathan.
Feels like tagging inside a church.
I'm still holding my can of yellow paint. I didn't want to come, and now you're telling me I can't even make my own tag? Henna frowns. They all frown. I frown too, what the hell? I'm having one of those days where I can't seem to say anything right, so screw it. Fine, I say, throwing the can at Nathan harder than really necessary. Let's just go home.
Oh shit,
Henna says, looking past me. I turn, and we all look. Down the train tracks, deep in the dark wooded area where they disappear, a whole crowd of glowing blue eyes is approaching. Henna is already running, scrambling down the embankment, trying to keep her balance with one arm. I run after her, checking only to see that Mel and Jared are running too. Nathan's lagging behind, staring into the darkness at the eyes.
What are they?
He says.
Just run, you moron!
I shout, grabbing Henna as she stumbles and practically dragging her toward my car. I shove her in the passenger seat and open the back doors for Mel and Jared as I run around the car as fast as I can. I hop behind the wheel and start the engine. Jared and Mel get inside.
Nathan is only just coming down the embankment.
Don't leave him,
Henna says, alarmed as I put the car in gear.
And for a moment there,
just for a second,
I almost do leave him.
He's running. He looks as frightened as any of us. But
whose idea was this?
I spit.
We would never have been here if it hadn't been for him.
Mikey, Jared starts. I'm going. I take my foot off the brake, but Nathan runs right in front of the car. He jumps in beside Jared, who's kept his door open.
Go, go, go!
Nathan yells, and I step on the gas. I shoot under the bridge, past the high school. There's nothing much back here, but there's a longer way home we can take. I speed there now, careening around a corner too fast. Everyone screams as we skid, but I correct it, and we're already sailing past the gym.
I don't think they're coming after us, Nathan says, looking out the back window.
And how do you know that, Nathan?
I say. He looks at me confused.
What?
Why did you drag us all out to the bridge tonight? Were you going to feed us to them? Is that what happened to the indie kids?
Mike,
Hannah says. Who are you? I shout into the rearview mirror, going way too fast down a darkened road. Where the hell did you come from?
I told you, Nathan said, still looking confused. Tulsa and Portland and...
I slam on the brakes, making everybody scream again. Get the hell out of my car.
Mike,
Hannah says more strongly.
What?
I roar at her.
It was my idea, she says.
The car is quiet, the motor vibrating. That's the only sound.
What?
I say again.
The bridge was my idea, she says. Nathan was feeling down, and I told him about the tradition and that we should see if anyone wanted to do it.
She said you'd probably say no, Nathan says, looking wounded. So I offered to ask because it'd be less embarrassing if you turned me down.
That's what happened, Mikey, Hannah says. Nathan didn't lead us there. I even suggested we do it tonight, remember?
She hardens a little.
And you don't believe I would have led us there, do you?
No, I don't.
Why didn't you just say? I would have done anything for you.
I'm so mad I'm on the verge of tears.
Anything? That's exactly the reason. I wanted it to be a friend's thing. Before we all go our separate ways. I didn't want it to be a favor to me because my arm is broken, or because of the car crash, or because you'd do anything. It's hard enough to be normal this month, isn't it? For anything to just be easy?
I look at her. I look back at Nathan, who's smart enough to keep his mouth shut. Mel and Jared aren't saying a word either. I remember what Jared said about me at his house. In this moment, he's never been more right. I'm the one here who's least wanted. Without another word, I put the car in gear and drive off down the road. A few miles later, Nathan breaks the silence. Don't I deserve an apology? I give him the finger and drive.
Chapter the 13th, in which the prince is tricked into turning Satchel and second indie kid Finn over to the Empress of the Immortals. He tries to save them, but is forced to sacrifice Finn to do so. Satchel refuses to accept this and, through only her own cunning and bravery, thwarts the Empress. She saves Finn, and as they flee, she steals a glimpse at the immortal Crux, the source of the immortals' power, through the gateway. It is full of charms and jewels, with an empty space in exactly the shape of her amulet.
B.
So what were they, do you think?
Mel asks me as she brushes our grandma's hair.
More cops?
I shrug from the chair next to grandma's bed. More deer? I don't know.
I wonder if we ever will.
And if we do, I wonder if we'll regret it. Our grandma leans against Mel's brush with her eyes closed, like Mary Magdalene when you scratch her between the ears. Mel's the only person she'll let do this. She never speaks while the brushing's happening, never mentions it when it's over, much less thanks her. But she'll sit still the whole time, enjoying it, quiet as a cat.
No one has died, though,
I say. Mel shushes me and crooks her head to Mrs. Richardson's empty bed. Someone did die. No idea how or when, but it must have been really recent, because they don't keep the beds empty here for long. Mrs. Choi is still in the bed by the window. She must be sad for Mrs. Richardson, because she barely waved when we came in. I lower my voice.
But that could just be because we're not indie kids. Or maybe it was just luck.
Do you really think Nathan has anything to do with it? Mel asks.
Because I don't, and I think I'm a pretty good judge of people.
I sigh out through my nose. Probably not.
How much of this is jealousy?
Probably all of it. Mel takes a final swipe with the brush.
You want me to plate it, Grandma?
Grandma says nothing, her head still back, her eyes still closed. Mel starts plating.
So,
she says, innocent in a way that I know something's coming.
You're going to start seeing someone?
Mom told you.
Only to ask if I wanted to see someone too.
it was actually surprisingly supportive.
I know. She's been different lately.
I'll bet she feels like she's graduating just like us, so she's finally noticing that the majority of her kids are leaving.
Isn't it funny how we're not even pretending Mr. Shuren has a chance?
He doesn't.
Mel folds up one large plate, isn't happy with it, starts over.
Dr. Luther again?
Dr. Luther was the psychiatrist I saw before, way back when. Mel saw her too, and for those few times we went as a whole family, it was Dr. Luther who tried to figure us out. This should be the place where I make fun of her, where I put her in my past as a goofy hippie chick, a lonely lady, soft as a wild herb, looking at us poor wounded kids with the eyes of a fawn. Except she wasn't. She gave off this air of, like, total competence. Like you didn't have to worry she didn't understand you, or that she didn't know what she was doing.
Any idea how much of a relief that is?
I think so, I say. Time is short, and it's better than having to start from scratch.
Time is short, Mel repeats. It is, isn't it?
It is. The Bolts of Fire concert is tomorrow. The prom is next week, then we graduate. Time is short. Mel folds our grandma's hair between her hands in a twist I couldn't even begin to replicate.
Could you hand me that?
Mel nods at a bottle of old-fashioned anti-tangle cream my grandma used to like. I hand it to her. She squirts a bunch into her hand and massages it into grandma's hair, filling the room with a really nice coconut smell. Grandma suddenly laughs, the smell triggering something.
What's funny, grandma?
Mel says, smiling. But our grandma just smiles back at her, and then at me.
You remember the islands, Philip?
Which islands? I say. She doesn't answer, just closes her eyes, still smiling.
Was grandma ever on islands? I ask Mel.
Vancouver Island, maybe, Mel says. But I don't think Canada really grows coconuts.
She finishes up with Grandma's hair, getting up from the bed and gently laying Grandma back down on her pillow. Grandma doesn't open her eyes again, and is asleep almost immediately. The usual ritual after Mel does her hair. Mel watches her, hands on her hips, brush in her hand.
She won't miss this when I leave, but that kind of makes me even sadder that I'll have to stop.
I know, I say, standing, getting ready to go.
Not yet, Mel says.
I sit back down, and she leans against the table by my grandma's bed. For a few minutes, we just watch my grandma and Mrs. Choi sleep, that empty bed in the middle seeming like a hole either of them could fall into at any moment. Mel's been spending a lot of time with Call Me Steve. She has also somehow managed not to tell our mother yet that Call Me Steve actually exists. She's afraid he'll become just another part of our mom's schedule, an issue to be dealt with, a point on a memo for her advisors. She's probably right. Mom's victory seems so assured, though, she's getting hardly any press coverage. They're concentrating on a nasty Senate race instead. My mom says this is the best thing that could happen, but I can also tell that the biggest deal in her life not being the biggest deal for everyone else is a little disappointing. Mel picks up her bag and takes out a plastic container. She opens it. I frown.
Is that your lunch?
We didn't eat together today. Mel was at the dentist getting a checkup on the enamel treatments she's been having to repair her teeth. But it wasn't a Novocaine type thing, and she could have eaten, should have eaten afterward.
Don't freak out, she says,
but I'm already standing, already kind of freaking out.
Mel! Mikey, please.
You can't start again. It's bad enough me doing it. I couldn't take losing you, Mel. I couldn't. She puts her hand on my mouth, rolling her eyes to our grandma, still sleeping.
Mel,
I whisper, and I'm nearly crying. I know what it's like to lose her, even for 3 or 4 minutes. It makes you live afraid every minute of every day that it's only a matter of time before it happens again. You can be happy, you can have fun, but it's always there. Always.
I have moments, Mikey, she says. You have them too, I know, and mine aren't as bad as yours. But with everything that's been going on...
Is it Steve?
I say, suddenly ready to break him in half with my hands.
No,
she says firmly.
He's nothing like that at all.
She sighs.
Though I did think about it. Like you would with anybody, like you'd want to be sure you looked attractive enough for someone you really like, even if he doesn't care about that stuff. Mel, like your scar.
This stops me. She puts her hand up to it like Hannah did, tracing it with her fingers. She drops her hand.
This is my scar. I carry it around. Most of the time, I don't even think about it.
But sometimes you do.
The world's uncertain, Mikey, she says.
And then she repeats the words from earlier.
Time is short.
We look down at her lunch. It's a wrap, Japanese style. Salmon, shoots, rice. There's a fork tucked in next to it. Mel takes it out. She hands it to me. I don't say anything, just look at the fork, look at her eyes asking me a question.
I'm going to be okay, she says. I really am. Just do this for me today, yeah? Like old times. Remind me that it's possible to feel safe.
She's keeping her voice steady, but I can see the nervousness in her arms and shoulders. She didn't eat her lunch, and it's probably a bit more serious than she's letting on. But it's also probably a bit less serious than in my worst worries. None of which makes me feel any better.
I would tell you if it was bad, she says. I wouldn't tell Dad, I wouldn't tell Mom, I wouldn't tell Meredith. But I tell you, I promise.
You promise? She smiles, and it's so true, my heart sort of hurts.
I really do, Mike. I don't want to die, I want to live. I want to live long enough so I can really live.
She shrugs, and it's more relaxed, I can see.
Just a blip in the day, and I need a reminder.
I believe her. I know what a blip is. I think I'd know the look of someone who was having more than a blip that freaked her out. They'd look like me. I get some salmon and rice on the fork. I lift it up. And I feed her. Mrs. Choi and our grandmother sleep. The room is quiet, that middle bed between them empty, empty, empty. And I feed my sister her lunch. We share our craziness, our neuroses, our little bit of screwed-upness that comes from our family. We share it, and it feels like love. I'm still mad, Hannah says. Are you sure you want to do this? I ask.
Did you hear me? I said I'm still mad.
Then you should be mad at yourself, because if you told me it was you who wanted to paint the bridge,
and yes, I'm sure.
She is still mad at me. I'm kind of mad at her, too. But she called asking me to drive her here tonight. Not Mel or Jared or Nathan. Me. And I said yes. Hannah Sylvan... The tattoo artist gives up even trying to pronounce her name from the list and just looks at her.
Sylvanoinen, Hannah says. It's Finnish.
Sympathies, the tattoo artist says. My last name's Ty. It's 7 syllables long. You ready?
Yep,
Hannah says, standing. She's 18. She doesn't need anyone's permission for this, though she had to prove it to the tattoo parlor receptionist guy when we came in the door. I'm still only 17, but that's okay, because I don't want to tattoo. Like, really, really not. You're definitely sure about this? I asked her 100 times on the drive over. You've never mentioned it before.
I never nearly died before,
is all she answered. She wouldn't tell me what she was planning on getting either, or how she found this place, or why we were waiting for this one particular tattoo guy to finish putting a hummingbird on a lady's upper boob. While we sat there, she did look through a catalog of different types of lettering, so I'm guessing it must be words. She didn't tell me what words, though, because she was too busy saying she was mad at me.
Hold on a sec, she says now, stopping me from following her in.
I wait as she goes to the tattoo guy's chair, He's called Martin, which seems really old-fashioned for a cool Thai tattoo guy. And they have a quiet conversation about what she wants and where she wants it. It's going to be on her side, by her stomach. The side away from where the cast is now. She shows the tattoo guy a piece of paper she didn't show me. He nods, draws a few things on it, and I hear Henna say, "Exactly." She gestures me over, making me sit on the other side from the tattoo so I won't be able to see it until it's done. Then she goes back to telling me how mad she is.
"You're too mean to him,"
she says as Martin preps her, cleaning and lubricating the patch of skin. Henna's so focused on me, it's like she gets tattoos every day.
"Your parents will go mental,"
I say, also not for the first time.
"My parents won't know. I'm not doing this for them."
"You really think they're not going to see it in Africa? You're never going to go swimming or sunbathing or..." Henna snorts.
"You obviously know nothing about missionaries."
Martin, the tattoo guy, holds up his needle, ready to start. "You're going to Africa?"
"Central African Republic," Henna says.
"Isn't there a war happening there?"
"Yes,"
I say. "Her crazy parents are taking her anyway." "I went through Tanzania, Malawi, and Zambia 2 years ago," Martin says. "Most amazing thing I've ever done in my life."
"Were they shooting at you?"
I say. "Not really." Martin turns on the power to his needle. "Now, no one here is going to pretend this doesn't actually hurt, but it's a pain you'll find bearable, I promise."
"Thanks," Henna says.
Then she looks up to me, eyes still annoyed, and holds out her non-cast hand across her chest for me to hold. I take it. She grunts slightly when Martin touches her with the needle, but she doesn't flinch. He paints in what must be a few dots, then asks, "How's that going to be? It won't get any worse, but it won't get any better either."
"Compared to how much my arm hurt," Henna says, "this is like a mild headache."
"Good." Martin carries on with the tattooing.
"You know, if your parents find out," I say, "they'll blame me and Mel for sending you off the rails." "Off the rails?" Henna asks, wincing. "You talk like an old woman sometimes, Mike."
"I talk like a politician. My mom has a speech where she says off the rails a lot when she's talking about the other party."
"Well, maybe it's time I went off the rails," Henna says, frowning. "Maybe I've been on the fucking rails for far too long."
"Language," Martin says, still tattooing. We both look at him. He's covered in tattoos, some of which aren't exactly family viewing. He sees us, shrugs. "Just a personal pet peeve. Everyone does it, so why be like everyone?" He sticks her again with the needle. Henna tenses up. I think she's holding her breath. He finishes, looks up. "That's one element done." He re-inks his needle and gets to work on the rest.
"How many elements are there?" I ask Henna. "Just never you mind," she says through gritted teeth.
A single tear escapes from her eye. I wipe it away with my free hand.
"Thanks," she says.
We don't say much through the rest of the tattoo. It takes a little over an hour, but from the area where I see Martin working, I don't think it's going to end up too big. A tattoo is out of character for Henna, which I think is her entire point, but a big, ugly tattoo, and she'd stop being Henna altogether. It'll be something right-sized and good. She looks down at it once, only once, during the whole procedure.
"I didn't know they bled," she says.
"No one ever does," Martin says. He finally finishes, gently pats the blood away, then covers it with a square of plastic wrap, taping it to her body. "No swimming for a month," he says, "and try to keep it out of the sun for as long as you can."
"Do you have a mirror?" Henna asks.
Martin gets up and brings over a large mirror that reflects her side and the brand new tattoo. Under the plastic wrap, her skin is livid from where it's been poked and written on. Blood wells up, but not as much as I might have thought. The tattoo is there, clear as day, reflected in the mirror. It's just one word, in some really amazingly beautiful lettering. No wonder she wanted Martin specifically. Henna takes my hand again, and she cries again, and I wipe away her tears again.
"I don't even think your parents would mind if those were the rails you were coming off of," I say. "I don't want them to know,"
she says. This is mine. All mine.
In the mirror, reflected backward, Hannah now has a tattoo that reads simply, Timo. I wake in the middle of the night for some reason or another. Maybe my own snoring was getting too loud or a dream I can't remember. I say this because I know it's not the car that wakes me. I don't hear it until I've turned over and made myself comfortable again. A car not my family's is rare at our end of this very, very wooded road, but not impossible. There's a turning just before us, and sometimes people miss it. But then I realize it's heading in the wrong direction. It's coming from the field. I get up without turning my light on and look out through my curtains. There's a car pulling slowly out of the entrance of the field, like you have to do because of all the mud and bumps. It's got its headlights off, and all I can make out are those small yellow lights on the side that some cars have for no apparent reason. I don't know how many times I have to tell you that it's dark out here. We've got street lights, but they're spaced far apart, and the closest is down the road a bit. Only enough to cast a shallow light as the car pulls out of the field and past my driveway. But it's enough to see the driver. It's Nathan. He's been parked in the field in the middle of the night. And now he's driving away with his lights off, hoping nobody sees him. Chapter the 14th, in which Satchel doubts the prince's intentions toward her. He weeps, professing his eternal love, one that he's been waiting to give for millennia, but had never found a repository for until he met Satchel. They kiss. It might lead to something, but then they hear the explosion from the outskirts of town. B.
But you said you didn't want to go, Meredith says to our mom. You said people took advantage of politicians and crowds, and that it was like having squirrels crawl all over your naked skin.
Try not to say that in public, sweetie, Mom says.
And while that may be true, Mommy's running for Congress now, and to be seen at a Bolts of Fire charity concert in my own future district, hopefully.
But you said you didn't want to go,
Meredith says again, apparently too stunned to get past her main point.
I didn't then, but I would like to go now.
Me and Mel wait behind Meredith. The concert's in an hour, pre-dusk, so all the little kiddies get home in time for bed. Meredith is covered, head to toe, in Bolts of Fire fan gear. T-shirt, twisty bracelets, belt, shoe buckles, tasseled trousers like Sapphire wears in the Bold Sapphire video. A cowboy hat that has the clean-shaven Caucasian faces of Bolts of Fire around the brim.
But you said...
Meredith, Mom warns. She looks at me and Mel. I'm going to take her. Why is that a big deal?
It's a little out of the blue, Mel says, frowning. Almost as if a campaign person heard you talking about it and suggested you go instead.
Mom's face hardens.
Neither of you even like this band. You're about 8 years older than their target audience. And you're about 30 years too old, Mel says.
There's nothing to discuss, our mom says briskly to Meredith. I'm your mom. I'm taking you.
But I've got 3 tickets, Meredith says.
Even better. Do you want your brother or your sister to join us?
Meredith looks back at both of us, looks at Mom, looks at both of us, looks at the floor, mumbles something.
What was that? Our mom asks.
I want them both,
Meredith says, sticking her brave little face up into the air, her chin trembling a little. She's so freakin' brainy you sometimes forget that she's still only a kid.
Well, you can't have them both. I want them both, Meredith says more strongly. They both said they would take me. I got tickets for all of us. If you had wanted to come, I could have tried to get 4, but you didn't. You said you didn't want to come.
My mom's eyes flash. There's always the possibility that no one gets to go.
I thought this campaign wouldn't interfere with our lives, I said.
When did I ever say that?
What about ferocious Mama Bear? Mel says. Did that mean you were just going to be ferocious to your kids?
My mom throws her hands up.
I genuinely don't understand what the problem is.
They're leaving! Meredith nearly shouts.
She's really crying now, her little arms crossed against her chest.
Hey,
I say to her, picking her up before my mom has a chance to. She's big, getting bigger, an unrecognizable teen before too long.